So I was pleased to learn last night that I'm not the oldest speaker at this conference. We'll be hearing from him shortly. Maybe this topic, though, will give away my age. This is kind of, I guess maybe you'll find this quaint, talking about counting models. I think model theory has sort of moved well beyond that, but still, there's some questions to ask, and I want to talk about some version of this general problem. Right, so given a class of your favorite class of structures, you want to be able to count the number of, you want to know how many non-isomorphic models there are of a given cardinality. And there's this function that maybe you're all aware of, this IC lambda, which tells you the number of non-isomorphic models in C of cardinality lambda. Now, so this was studied intensively by model theorists last century, and I guess we have a very good understanding of this function for elementary classes and for infinite cardinals bigger than the size of the language. So I don't need the word countable there. I think even for uncountable, we know this function quite well when lambda is big enough. And there's a paper by Udi and Brad and Chris that really list all the possible spectrum functions for, is it for just countable, overcountable languages? Yeah. Okay, so that's known, what the possible functions are for lambda. For C, an elementary class overcountable language, and lambda, uncountable. All right. Also, last century, Brad and Sergey and I looked at this question in the context of equationally defined classes of algebraic structures. These are called varieties. So yeah, variety is a class of algebraic structures, a structure in a language with no relation symbols other than equality. And again, it's defined by equations, or alternatively, it's a class closed under these three class operations, the taking of homomorphic images, subalgebras, and Cartesian products. So I'm a universal algebraist, so this is the kind of class I look at. Okay, so here's one version of a result for varieties. This tells you the possible spectrum functions for countable varieties. Again, this is work with Brad and Sergey from the 1980s. I couldn't figure out how to get the BEST symbol last night at 1 a.m., so I just put a B in there. I hope you won't mind too much. And I won't talk about this. That's the result. You can read it if you want. There's the possible functions that can arise for a variety over a countable language. I'll come back to, another theorem that we proved that really tells you why these are the functions that come up. There's a strong structural reason for this thing happening. Okay, so in some sense, this function is understood well for infinite models. What I want to look at the finite case. So how can you count finite structures in a class, and in particular as we'll see in a variety. Well, that's the question I'll be addressing today. How can you count in some reasonable way finite algebras in an equationally defined class of structures? Well, this sort of says. Then in some sense, this is not a very interesting question, that if you just look at arbitrary elementary classes, if you can take your favorite function from omega to omega, you can find a first order theory which has f of k models of size k for every k. So lots of things can happen there. If you restrict yourself to a finite language, then, well, still, you can say something, but nothing too interesting. So the way it's phrased, this question is just way too general. You just can't hope to have interesting results when you're looking at arbitrary, elementary classes. But even if you look at equational classes, still you can't say a whole lot of interest. So we'll shift the question slightly. This is probably not the right function to be looking at when you're looking at finite algebras. So this is a definition that was Initially, they're just presented by Berman and Idjak, actually while they were working here at the during the algebraic model theory conference program in 96, 97. They initiated the study of this function. So rather than counting algebras of a given size k, we'll look at algebras with a given number of generators. That seems much more natural when dealing with algebraic structures. Quite often, you're presented with structures in terms of generators. So this function, the G spectrum, G for generator, I guess, counts the number of pairwise non-isomorphic members of C that are generated by at most k elements. And they initiate a study of this function, here at Fields. So that's what I'll be talking about today, this function G sub C. And in some sense, I guess you could redefine the I C lambda for lambda infinite. You might as well be talking about generators when lambda is infinite or bigger than the size of language. So this is closely connected with that function as well. Now, for arbitrary varieties, again, this function G sub V can be quite wild. It may not even be integer valued. So we'll specialize to a particular kind of variety which really is grounded in the finite. So here's a couple of definitions. A variety is locally finite if every finitely generated algebra in it is finite. And specialization that as to the finitely generated variety. So a variety is finitely generated if it's generated by single finite algebra. So one way to get a variety from a class of algebras or a single algebra is to first close under products, then subalgebras, and then homomorphic images. And this produces a variety. So the theorems I'll present today are really about locally finite and finitely generated varieties. Yeah, I guess an obvious thing to note is if we're dealing with locally finite, maybe I should be careful here. When V is locally finite and G finite language to conclude that there are only finitely many. Oh, never mind. Yeah. So for V locally finite, this function G sub V is integer valued. For a given K, there can only be a finite number of K generated algebras in V up to isomorphism. And yeah, that gets this last point shows that even in the context of locally finite variety, you can't say a whole lot of interest. That you can find locally finite varieties that dominate, which have the property that this G sub B dominates any given sequence of integers. So we'll pretty much be talking about finitely generated varieties from here on in. Now, there's another function that is close related to this G function called the free spectrum of variety. You can count the size of the K-generated free algebra in a given variety, and there's some close association between the size of the free algebras and this G-spectrum function. The first point follows because every K-generated algebra in a variety is a quotient of the K-generated free algebra. So this puts up a bound of the number of K-generated algebras. You can just, you've got your K-generated free algebra. How many possible quotients can there be? Well, at most two to that size. So this puts a bound on the G spectrum in terms of the sizes of the free algebras. And conversely, you can bound the free algebra in terms of the number of K-generated algebras. That's a little more complicated, and I won't discuss why that's true. But the interesting consequence here is that in the finely generated case, you can bound the G spectrum by a triply exponential function. Because the free algebras grow at a rate of the doubly exponential, at least the growth rate can be bounded by a doubly exponential function. So in the context of finely generated varieties, we have some chance of proving some nice theorems that we can look at the growth rate of this function and know that it, in all cases, will be bounded by some triply exponential function. Okay, so let's look at some examples. Yeah, I guess the first two are hopefully obvious. How many K-generated sets are there? at most, k generates sets. So we have to look at k minus 1 as well, and so on down to the one element set. So the spectrum function for the variety of sets is just k. And for vector spaces, more or less the same thing. How many k-generated vector spaces are there over a finite field? Well, we have the zero-dimensional vector space to count as well. That's why we have k plus 1 in that case. Boolean algebras. Well, the k-generated free Boolean algebra has size 2 to the 2 to the k and 2 to the k atoms. Any k-generated Boolean algebra is a quotient of that, and really it's determined by the number of atoms it has. And you can find, well, you can find k-generated Boolean algebras with 0 up to 2 to the k different atoms. So that's the function for the variety of Boolean algebras. Now, the point 4, just I'm not going to talk about why these, the variety of distributive lattices and semi-lattices are bad. They have very fast-growing spectrum functions. But they play an important role in what's to follow. And yeah, I guess this other item 5 is, well, not too hard to prove. And maybe I'll just spend a second or two talking about or indicating why we can get a handle on the multi-unary case. So if we're dealing with a unary variety where all the operations are permutations or constants, then you can really very easily write down the possible structures in that that variety. They're really determined by orbits of, it's really just like a G set. There's a group here acting on a set with some possible constants floating around too. So really we're looking at K-generated G sets. And so you'll have K, up to K orbits in your K-generated structure. And there are only a finite number of possible types for each of these orbits. Again, determined by the underlying group. So it doesn't take much to count the possible combinations of orbits if you only have k of them to work with. So you can quite easily write down a polynomial that bounds the size of the G spectrum in that case. On the other hand, if the variety has a non-permutational operation, then, well, I won't go, I'll give you sort of a generic example. You can, say you have a unary function that is not a permutation. So you can go, you start with a free generator x and apply this non-permutational function f of x. Well, you can use this, and so there may be other things going on, but the point is you can't get back to x by applying any other operation in your variety. You can code up equivalence relations into this variety in the following way. If you take a k-element partition, a partition of the k-element set, what you can do is build a k-generated unary structure by sort of copying this k times. And then making a quotient, so identifying these things down here, for all the elements that are in the given block. So you take a quotient of this k-generated tree algebra by quotienting out according to this partition, and you can recover from the isomorphism type of this quotient the original partition. So there's a way of coding up partitions on a k-element set into k-generated algebras, and since there are lots of partitions, that means that we can't put a polynomial bound on the k-generated algebras, or on the g-spectrum of this kind of variety. So, again, we'll come back to this a little later, because this will play, again, a role in the more general result I want to talk about. All right, so here's the real problem that we will talk about today. So the problem is to characterize the finely generated varieties whose G spectra are bounded by some polynomial. Remember that at worst they can be triply exponential, and so this is looking at things that have, well, few finite models. And from the previous slide we know that Boolean algebras, lattices, and semi-lattices all fail to have this property. Okay, so one of the first things that Berman and Ijak proved is that if you have a finely generated variety with few finite models, with a G spectrum that grows at most polynomially, then locally we can't have any of this bad behavior. We can't have Boolean algebras floating around or lattices or semi-lattices. I'm calling this theorem version 1 because this is rather imprecise. What do I mean by locally? And so the key tool here that we use to make this precise is called tame congruence theory. Hobby and McKenzie in the 80s developed a local structure theory for finite algebraic structures. It's really quite an amazing collection of results and ideas, and it's revolutionized the study of finite algebraic structures and has been used to prove lots of interesting results to do with locally finite and finitely generated varieties. And so this is an example of how we can use the structure theorem to prove some interesting results. As I say, it's really an amazing collection of ideas and results. And it'd be nice if we could find some way to use this outside of universal algebra somehow. So far, the results we've got using this all are sort of inward-looking into the subject. We haven't really used this to prove results that, people beyond the model theory community might find all that interesting. So we're still looking for applications. But let me just give you a five-minute overview of how this theory works. So, yeah, they develop a notion of neighborhood or minimal set for an algebraic structure. You've got given a finite algebra A, you can look at the polynomials of this algebra. These are operations derived from terms by using parameters. And we can look at the ranges of unary polynomials and look at the ranges that polynomials have minimal ranges. Now, in a certain situation or a certain context, it turns out that these ranges have a very nice structure. So if you look in the right places, that you get this result that locally, so we think of these minimal sets as being the neighborhoods of our algebra. And one of the amazing results of tame congruence theory is that these minimal sets can behave in a very few numbers of ways. There's five possible behaviors for these minimal sets. So locally, an algebra can behave as a unary algebra, and actually more can be said that this unary algebra is actually permutational. So essentially, we've got locally a G-set action. Or it can behave as an affine structure, in fact, as a vector space over a finite field. Or these sort of, I guess I won't call them degenerate cases, but or they must be two-element neighborhoods and behaving as Boolean algebras, lattices, or semilattices. So you've got this arbitrary finite algebra and a way of looking into it and seeing locally all these nice structures. And these are the only kinds of structures that can arise in this sense. Pardon me? Oh, yeah, that's where very interesting things happen. You actually exploit these kinds of interactions to prove results like having many models or undecidability. If you have a Boolean algebra or acting on a set or a set acting on an affine structure in just the wrong way, you can exploit that to get undecidability results, and you can interpret graphs. Lots of things can happen when you have these interactions. So maybe I'll give a few more details about this structure, these ideas in the context of a simple algebra. Things are much cleaner there, and really all that happens is we relativize what happens in the simple case to arbitrary algebras. So let's imagine A is simple. By that I mean that the only congruences of A are the trivial ones, or the only quotients of A are the trivial ones. So A simple just means that the only quotients of A are A and, the one-element algebra. It's just generalized what it means for a group to be simple. Okay, so in for a simple algebra, a lot more can be said about these minimal sets. So again, we've got a simple algebra and we've got a notion of a neighborhood or a minimal set. It turns out that the minimal sets cover the entire algebra. You can almost think of it as a manifold of some sort, that these things cover the entire algebra. They're all isomorphic via polynomials, so these isomorphisms are in the algebra itself. Again, they're all of one of five types. They're all vector spaces, say, or two-element Boolean algebras, or whatever. And another very useful property is that if you consider, if you fix one minimal set and consider all the polynomials of A that map into this one minimal set, then these polynomials separate points. So given two points in your algebra, you can find a polynomial that maps them into this given minimal set and keeps them distinct. Right, so again, you can think of this simple algebra as some sort of, well, almost geometric structure. You've got these nice overlapping, well-behaved things, and you can do quite a lot with that. I'd say you can relativize this to arbitrary algebras. In the case where we're dealing with a non-simple algebra, we look at a very important invariant called the congruence lattice. This is just the lattice of all essentially kernels of homomorphisms from A into other algebras. There's always the least congruence and the largest. And what we can do is look at a pair of congruences, alpha covered by beta. So in this finite congruence lattice, you can look at covering pairs. And we can relativize all these ideas to this pair. Essentially what you do is you quotient out by alpha, and we get similar sorts of a similar sort of picture for the beta classes modulo alpha, that they're all look like this sort of thing. And so we can assign a label to each of these pairs depending on the local behavior of the beta classes modulo alpha. There's five possibilities. Locally, the beta classes mod alpha could be unary, affine, or one of these other ordered types. And so we have a notion of a labeled congruence lattice that, again, has proved to be quite a useful notion. Yeah, question? Well, you can. So in the labeled congruence lattice, you can find algebras where different labels occur. But within a given beta class, there's all this uniformity, just as in the simple case. So, if you look at the congruence lattice of simple algebra, there's just the two trivial congruences. There's a fixed label there, depending on the local behavior. So, you've got this congruence lattice, and to each covering pair, you can assign a label, depending on the local behavior. Okay, so let me give it the version 2 of the Berman-Ijack result right there. So again, we're looking at finely generated equational classes, and assuming that there's a polynomial bound on the number of K-generated algebras in this variety, then, we've got a type-limiting theorem that locally these three types can't occur. You can't have locally a Boolean algebra appearing, or lattices or semi-lattices. So that means that in the labeled congruence lattices of algebras in this variety, you only see the unary and affine types. And such a variety that emits these ordered types, Boolean, lattice, and semi-lattice, are called solvable. There's a notion of solvability that works quite well and really generalizes the notion of solvability from group theory. And as a way of characterizing in terms of this local behavior. So the first result says that finitely generated varieties with few finite models are solvable. You can't have any of this ordered type behavior appearing. Right, and Bob, if you were aware of the work of Brad and Sergey and from the 90s and 80s, this should recall this kind of result, that we get a similar statement if we change the hypothesis from having few finite models to having few infinite models. So one of the results that really came out of the study of decidable varieties is this first one, that if you have few infinite models, then again, you have to omit Boolean algebras, lattices, and semi-lattices. And in fact, if you just impose the condition of being stable, then it'd probably be an easy exercise for all the model theorists in the audience to prove this kind of thing. If you have in your class an ordered structure of any kind, you're bound to get many models, many infinite models. And as I say, we also have a result that is connected with decidability. So a variety is decidable if its first order theory is recursive. And Mackenzie, one of the first results he proved with this tame congruence theory was this one, that in a locally finite decidable variety, then you can have lattice and semi-lattice types floating around. Of course, you can have Boolean algebra types because the variety of Boolean algebras is decidable. So we can't omit those if we're just looking at decidable varieties. It would have been nice if we could have taken these results and these constructions and just lifted them to get the Berman-Ijak result. But it's not so simple. Here we're looking at isomorphism types of structures, whereas here we're just looking at essentially the first order theory. And say the way to get this result is that if you have a lattice or semi-lattice type floating around in your variety, then you can semantically embed the variety of lattices into your variety, or the variety of semi-lattices into your variety. And since the theory of lattices or semi-lattices is undecidable, that translates over to the theory of V. Now, this interpretation of lattices into V relies heavily on parameters, because we're dealing with polynomials. The thing that drives this theory of minimal sets are not terms, but polynomials. So we rely heavily on parameters. But when you're dealing with isomorphism type, then these parameters get in the way. And so we can't just lift the results from decidability to get these results for the G spectrum. It's a little more subtle and a little more complicated. But Berman and Ijak were able to get around this problem with parameters to get their results. Okay, so I'm heading towards the... There is a nice characterization of these polybounded, varieties of polybounded G spectra, and I want to introduce some terms that will get us to the statement. So, yeah, I guess this first appeared in a paper by Baldwin and McKenzie. They were looking at varieties with few infinite models, and they observed that if a variety has few infinite models, then not only do we have this solvability working for us, but in fact, we have a much stronger regularity condition called the abelian condition. And it's stated right here. It just says if you have an equality of this sort, then you can replace the parameter A by B and preserve equality. Again, a simple exercise for the model theorist to show that if this fails, you have instability. That's essentially what's in the Baldwin-McKenzie paper. They I guess they do it in two ways, but certainly they note that if this fails, then the theory is unstable, and so we have lots of infinite models. Okay, so McKenzie takes the Baldwin-Ijak result one step further and shows that not only do we have solvability, but in fact we have this much stronger condition. This condition, the abelian condition, can't hold at all if you have locally Boolean algebras or lattices or semi-lattices. These are inherently non-abelian structures. So this is really a strengthening of the earlier result. And it's a very, very difficult proof. I'm not sure how he found it, but it's good to know that. All right, what's this theorem say? Right, another theorem on the way to prove the general result is this one by Ijak and McKenzie. Here they look at a special case, looking at locally finite varieties that omit this unary behavior locally. You can replace the hypothesis of omitting this unary behavior by something like having modular congruence lattices. Any reasonable sort of variety, any sort of classical variety, will usually satisfy this condition of omitting the unary type. So this result covers a large number of well-known varieties. And so they prove that if you have one of these varieties and it has a bounded, its G-spectrum is bounded by a polynomial, then it's essentially an affine variety. That it's polynomial equivalent to a variety of modules over some finite ring, a finite representation type. And it's actually if and only if. If you have such a variety of modules, then it's not hard to show that the G-spectrum is bounded by a polynomial. So the classical case, we've got a very nice result that essentially we're dealing with modules over some nice finite ring. But the problem comes in when you have to deal with these unary structures locally. You can't, well, things get a lot more complicated. Okay, so yeah, let's go on to the first version of the general result. Again, this should recall results from the varieties with few models and decidable varieties. So we take an arbitrary locally finite variety V, and we assume that it has few finite models. What we can conclude is something quite strong, that really V decomposes of the product in some really strong sense of two fairly well-behaved varieties. V is a product of an affine variety and a variety which isn't unary but is definitionally equivalent to a multi-sorted unary structure. There's a way of going from a k-sorted structure to a one-sorted structure in some natural algebraic way, and we can see this factor in this way. So, yeah, so here's the definition of how this product works. It means that every algebra in this variety is isomorphic to a product of an algebra from the first variety and the second, and in some sense we have a term which gives you the projection. So it's a very strong sort of decomposition. Now, I won't say too much about the how this is proved, but we have a similar result for let me put that on the board for decidable varieties. That if we replace this G spectrum hypothesis by decidability, a decidability assumption, then we get a slightly different result. But we have to add this other factor because, as noted earlier, Boolean algebras have a decidable theory. So it turns out that every decidable locally finite variety must look like this. It's a product of three very special sorts of varieties: an affine variety, this multi-sorted unary structure variety, and something that's called a discriminator variety. It's really Boolean-like. It's has a very nice representation in terms of sheaves. But I won't go into that right now. So we had this result. This is from the 80s, and we had all these constructions that forced this kind of structure. And as I mentioned earlier, it would have been nice if we could have just taken these constructions and applied them in the this G-spectrum context. But say we have all these parameters floating around and things didn't always work out. But let's go back to the definition of the Abelian condition. It says something interesting about parameters, that if we're just interested in, say, the kernels of polynomials, this really says that the kernel is independent of your choice of parameters. And that's a key observation, that really a lot of our constructions just hinge on knowing something about kernels of polynomials. And when we know we have the Abelian property floating around, we then know that this apparent dependence on parameters really isn't so bad. We can get around that. So that's what happens in getting this theorem. We had constructions that worked or provided this result, and we could tweak them by using the Abelian condition to get them to work over in this case. Yeah, I guess there's also another result I should put up here too. Then this is the structure theorem that drove the earlier result where I listed all the possible spectrum functions for varieties. It really arises from this result. And here we're assuming that we have superstability or few countable models or few infinite models that forces this very nice structure theorem. As noted, we have from Baldwin and McKenzie the variety is Abelian, and then we can force this kind of decomposition as well. So there's other qualifiers here. The unary part is actually multi-sorted unary, and these other two conditions, linearity and ascending chain condition. Essentially, the ascending chain condition says that you can't have in a one-generated algebra in your variety infinite increasing chain of substructures. That if you have that, you can build lots of models. And linearity says that the partial ordering of substructures in a one-generated algebra, it forms a chain. So we have a very good understanding of a structure in sort of superstable varieties, and again, it's really these ideas which we use to get the G-spectrum resolved. Okay, so here's version 2, and maybe the final version, I guess, of our theorem on varieties with few finite models. Really what's changed here is that we can give more information about the unary side of things. We still have possibly have the affine factor, but now we can say more about the unary parts. Really what's happening here is that let me draw a picture of what the unary part could look like. So think of a K-sorted unary structure. So we've got these K-sorts and have maps going back and forth between some of the sorts. Who knows what arrangement we have. One of the first examples I gave, I argued that for a unary structure to have few finite models, it must be essentially permutational. Well, that carries over to the K-sorted case. So we can conclude if we have few finite models, that every unary operation pictured here must essentially have an inverse, must be permutational. And using these permutations floating around, we can sort of group the sorts according to whether they're maps or connections between them. And these permutational connections between the sorts then gives rise to this kind of structure, where what we're seeing is a number of G sets and copies of them by these permutations. Yeah, this is a definition of this called the matrix power. And so what we have here are factors are matrix powers of G sets with some constants floating around. The definition is again pretty obscure, but really it's a generalization of what happens with Morita equivalents. You can go from a module over a ring to k by k matrices of that module over R to the K. So there's this strong connection, this Morita equivalence, and this is really a generalization of that. The algebra A is quite close related to this its matrix power A to the K. Very strong connections. And so what's really going on here then is we've got essentially some G sets or some things that are very closely related to G sets along with an affine bit. And that's the result. So we have a very clear picture of what the locally finite varieties are with this which have polybonded G spectra. I've sort of indicated how these things work, but just the general approach, the general method is we look at trying to interpret some class where we know we have lots and lots of models, say for example graphs. And we're able to do that in the proof of this result. But if the structure fails, what will often happen is that we can find a way of interpreting graphs into the variety in some nice uniform way. Given a graph G, we can find an algebra in the variety with roughly G generators, the size of G generators, and somehow we're able to recover the isomorphism type of the graph from the algebra A of G. Again, we also do this with decidability, but again, there's this issue of parameters floating around that makes this job a little more difficult. But the idea is we have a uniform way of interpreting graphs or partitions or equivalence relations into our variety if it fails to have this nice structure, and then we can recover these structures in some nice way. All right, so that's maybe all I wanted to say about that theorem. We have a good understanding of varieties with few finite models. There's more to say, though. What about varieties which... So I mentioned that in the worst case, G of V could be triply exponential. So we have an understanding when this function is quite slow growing, but what about when, what can we say when we know that we can bound G by a singly exponential function? Can we extract anything useful about the structure of such a variety? And, well, in fact, we can. And this is another result due to Berman and Idjak. This is getting a little more technical. Unfortunately, things aren't so nice there. So they do have a complete list of conditions that are equivalent to having, this exponential, singly exponential bound on the G spectrum. And what can I say about this? Yeah, I guess maybe it's amazing I've gone 40 minutes without mentioning subdirectly irreducible algebras. They're sort of the building blocks of varieties. It would have been nice if every algebra in a variety is isomorphic to, say, a Cartesian product of directly indecomposables, but that can't happen. So we have to relax the notion of directly indecomposable to something called subdirectly irreducible. There's a notion of subdirect product, and with respect to that notion of product, there's a notion of an irreducible. And it turns out that every algebra in a variety is isomorphic to a subdirect product of subdirectly irreducibles. So in some sense, the subdirectly irreducibles really determine the variety. And so to understand a variety, you certainly want to understand the subdirectly irreducibles. Now, they can be characterized in various ways in terms of this notion of subdirect product, but you can also characterize them in terms of their congruence lattice. So here's what the congruence lattice of a subdirectly irreducible algebra looks like. It's got, of course, always has the trivial zero congruence and the trivial one congruence. An algebra is subdirectly irreducible if and only if there's a unique cover of zero, usually called the monolith. All right, so we want to study these kinds of algebras. And lots of theorems that don't deal with varieties are really stated in terms of the nature of the subdirectly irreducibles. So what does this theorem say? Right, if you have this singly exponential bound on a variety, then for one thing, the congruences are quite well behaved. They permute. So having permuting congruences means the lattice is actually modular. And so there's a rich theory of congruence permutable varieties. So we have permutability, which again, is a very strong assumption. And then the second bullet just talks about the nature of the subdirectly irreducibles. I mentioned we had a notion of solvability. We have a notion of centrality that works in general. It generalizes that notion from groups. And so we can talk about the centralizer of a given congruence, and in particular the centralizer of the monolith right there. And so, again, as radicals is floating around as well, we can talk about the largest solvable congruence, and it turns out this centralizer must be the solvable radical of the algebra. It's comparable to all congruences. So really, we have this picture emerging. Has to look like that. This thing must be abelian or nilpotent. Again, we have all these nice notions floating around of coming from solvability and centrality. We have a coherent notion of nilpotence. So again, just maybe there's no point in going through this entire list, but the point is we have lots of information about the subdirectly irreducibles and in fact, I'll spare you the details, but there is a complete characterization of varieties whose G spectrum is bounded by a singly exponential function. Now, the nature of this characterization is of the following sort. So we have all these solvable congruences floating around, and associated with solvable congruences are vector spaces or affine structures. So given one of these varieties, there's a whole class of associated affine structures or varieties. For each congruence, each abelian congruence, we can associate a ring. This collection of rings that are determined by the variety V, and for each of those rings, we have varieties of modules. And the counting of the fine structures comes down to counting modules over these rings that are determined by these abelian congruences. So their characterization is in terms of the kinds of modules that appear when we look at these abelian congruences. And that's it. So if you have all the structure plus the associated modules are well-behaved, then we get this nice bound. All right. So there's still some work to be done here. I guess I skipped over a key point in this theorem, that this only works when we omit the unary type. That don't have a fully general result. They're only looking in more or less like the classical context. That they haven't been able to deal with varieties in the full generality that we were able to with the few models case. That's a challenge. How do you handle the unary behavior in this context? And so that's an obvious question to raise. How do we extend this result to include all of the finally generated varieties? And, well, an even more direct question, how do you just deal with a variety which just has unary behavior locally? I don't think there's a characterization of that yet. I mentioned that solvability is correlated to having only unary and affine behavior locally. There's a notion of strong solvability and strong abelianness that is correlated with having only unary behavior locally. And again, this is a well-developed concept in universal algebra. And so even just looking at pure unary type situation, we don't really have a characterization of these varieties with a singly exponentially bounded G spectrum. So that would be, the obvious place to look at next. And I think I'll stop there. So thanks.